Okay, we're beginning here on Ayin Hey Amud Bet, 16 lines up from the bottom, by Rav Amar, which is the second answer now being presented with regards to the difficulty of our Mishnah. Our Mishnah indicates that there are two scenarios. There's one scenario where we find the mumim be'oda be'beit avia. In that case, the burden of proof lies with the father. And then we have the second half of the Mishnah, which is when the mumim are found in the beit habaal, when they're found when she's already by the husband's side, then the burden of proof is on him. So then the Gemara wanted to ask about that. We had in the beginning of the Masechta, we had a machloket Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua as to the din of chezkat aguf. How much power does the fact that the woman has a chezkat aguf, that she was born as a bitula, how much weight does that carry in determining the burden of proof of the two sides here? If when the husband now marries her and finds that she's not a bitula, who do we say has to bring the proof here that it happened prior to the Erusin or after the Erusin? Meaning the Chezkat Aguf, does it carry through to the point where the obligations on the husband to bring the proof? Or do we say that, no, lo mipia anu chayim, we don't live by her word of her mouth that it happened after the Erusin, and the burden of proof is actually on her? Happens to be a machloket Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. And Rabbi Elazar actually answered our mission in that way, Tavra, Mishishanazo, Lo Shanazo, that the Mishnah here has two pieces of authorship to it. One half of it is authored by Rabbi Gamliel, and one half of it is authored by Rabbi Yoshua. And in Hochanami, if you had made it all Rabbi Gamliel, then we would follow the Chezkat Aguf all the time, and the woman would be in a better position, like in the beginning of the Masechta. Or if it was all Rabbi Yoshua, then we would not follow the Chezkat Aguf, and lo mipia anu chayin, and that would be the same throughout the Mishnah here. So the fact that there's a difference between who has the burden of proof, depending on where the mum is found, that's according to two different opinions. And therefore, if you just stayed steady with one opinion, then you would end up with the same result. The burden of proof would always be with the party that Tana believes. So that's the way Rabbi Elazar answered the question. Now, Rava introduces a possibility of making the Mishnah single authorship. Reisha, Kan nimtzu v'kan hayu. Seifanami kan nimtzu v'kan hayu. So Rava enters a new logic, and then the logic he's suggesting is that where they were found, that's where they were. So if we find the mumim while she's in her father's house, we assume that that's where they were. They were in her father's house. We find the mumim when she's in the Baal's house, then we assume that they happened in the Baal's house. Etave abaye. So Abaye challenges Rava and says, Nichnasa the Rishut HaBaal, when she goes into the Rishut, the possession of the Baal, HaBaal Tzarech Lavi Raya. He has to bring proof, She'ad Shalot Titares, Hayao Ba'amumim Elu, that he has to prove that prior to the Erusin, these Mumim were there on the woman. And that he has a Mekach Ta'ot. So then Abaye says, Ad Shalot Titares In. That means that if he can prove that the mumim were there prior to the erusin, does he get to not pay the ketubah? Mishitateres, lo. But if he can only prove that the mumim were there after erusin, he's out of luck. Ve'amai. Why would you say that? Lema kan nimtzu v'kan hayu. If the principle is that whatever they were found, that's where they happened, then all he has to do is prove that they were there prior to the fact that she came into his possession. She came into his possession at Nisuin. The threshold for him is Nisuin. That's where it changes from Beit Avia to Beit Baalo. So why does he have to bring proof that it happened all the way before the Erusin in order to get the upper hand here? All he should have to do is prove that it happened prior to coming into his possession, prior to Nisuin. So why does the Mishnah here suggest that it has to be all the way back prior to Erusin? So Rava responds to him, says Mishnah Nitarsa, if he can only prove that the Mumim were there after the engagement, Mishum the Ikal Meimar, because there is what to say there, which is Chazaka, Ein Adam Shote Bekos, Elim Kein Botko. A person does not drink from a cup before looking into it. People don't do blind tests. When they look at something, they want to know what's in there. They want to eat or drink things that they know. And the same thing over here. A person does not marry the woman unless he's done a thorough check of the woman. He saw her, he knew about it, and he accepted it. That's going to be our assumption. So Gemara says, Ihachi, Ad Shalot Titares Nami. If the fact that now we found the Mumim Baal is saying, I found this mum here, and it's in the house of the Baal at this point. So now, if he can prove that it was way back before, we would say, okay, then the problem was the father's problem. But the Gemara here says, wait, you just introduced this possibility that as soon as we're past the threshold of Nisuin, we assume that he saw it and he accepted it. So then why should it matter when he can prove that there was a mum there? If the mum was there before Erusin or after Erusin, our assumption is once he got married, he accepted whatever he saw. He knew about it, and he accepted. So why should it matter if he can prove it's after Erusin or before Erusin? Ella, Amrinan, Hazaka in Adam, Mipayes b'mumim. We have another side to this, which is a person doesn't ever give in with regards to mumim. Mumim are significant enough that nobody would agree to a marriage in the face of these mumim. So now you have these competing ideas. One idea is that if he's already married and had nisuin, that he definitely accepted the mumim. On the other hand, we say that we would not automatically assume, or generally would not assume, that a person would be willing to accept these mumim. So now you have this tension between these two ideas. Hachanami. So the same thing here. Chazak ein adam mefayes b'mumim. So you could say the same thing over here. If he proves that it was after he was in the mum, we should also say that when he got married, he would never be willing to accept this. And even if he didn't know about it, he clearly wouldn't have accepted it, because it's just not something that's reasonable that a person would accept. Ella. So here's the idea that is borne out by Rova's position. Mishin nitarsa. Once there's a rusim, mishum de ikatarte. Now we have two things. So here you actually have a setup of chazakot, and we're going to lay out for basically here different numbers of chazakot on each side. And we're going to weigh and see which chazakot support which position. So if he can only prove that the mum happened after Erusin. So again, the scenario here is that the husband found the mum after Nisuin already. And now he's going to get Edim that the mum pre-existed the Nisuin. He's able to find Edim that the mum was there after Erusin. But he can't find an Edim that it was prior to Erusin. So now what are the chazakot that we're faced with? So now we have two. Chazaka, Hemed Guf Achazkato. The first thing is that the woman or the baby is born, and they're born in a whole manner. We're assuming here it's not a congenital mum. And therefore, the chazaka of the guf is in favor of the woman, that the mum did not exist. I mean, that we know now that there's a mum, but he can only prove the starting point of that mum after Erusin. So as far as prior to that point in time, we'll give the chazaka to the guf that there was nothing there. Number two is, chazaka ein adam shote bekos elim bodko. In supporting her as well, is that the fact that he's already passed Nisuin means that he knew about it and he accepted it. So that's two chazakot in favor of the woman. One chazaka is that her body should be whole, and therefore, if he can't prove before the Erusin, then we assume that she was fine prior to Erusin. And also number two is that he's married already. He's not just Erusin, he has Nisuin, and that should mean that he accepted the mumim. Vahaira avinifayesu. So my amart. So now you have an offsetting chazaka, which is chazaka in adam mefayez b'mumim. You have the other side, which is a person does not agree or would never agree to accept mumim. Havichada b'makom tarte. That's one chazaka going up against two chazakot. And since you have one against two, chada b'makom tarte, lo amrinan. When you have one against two, then you do not deal with it. Now really, over here, there are actually four chazakot that are here. The Gemara here is ignoring one of the chazakot, which we'll bring up in the next scenario. And then once we've done that, we'll show why it wasn't relevant in the first scenario. Which is, next is, achilo titares. If he's able to prove that the mum was there prior to the Erusin, then, hemed gufa chazkato loika de meimar. You can't say hemed gufa chazkato, that she was a shalem, because he already proved that there was a mum there prior to the Erusin. So that chazaka drops away. So ma'ika, what's left? Chazaka dein adam shote bekos elimikain botko v'hai ra'av nefayesu. So what are you going to say? Because he has nisuin already, this is post-nisuin, he must have known about it and accepted it. So that chazaka would go in favor of the woman. Adarabo, chazaka ein adam nefayes b'mumim. Wait a minute, so they have the other side, is that a person would never accept mumim. So now we have one against one, but then you have an additional chazaka, which is hemed mamon al chazkato. Put the mamon, the money, where it is. The money is sitting with the husband right now. He's the one who's obligated to pay out the tubah at this point in time. So the Chazkat HaMamon is with him. So he has two against one. He has the Chazkat HaMamon, and he has the Chazaka that people in general would not accept Mumim. Those two items will lean in favor of him versus the woman who only has a Chazaka that he's married already, and he accepted it. Now, what happened to the Chazkat HaMamon in the case where he finds it after Irusin? How come the Gemara did not raise the issue of Chazkat HaMamon there? That would actually make it two against two. Because in the case where he finds a deem that it happened after Irusin, then in the woman's favor, him a guf al chazkato, and you have that he's married to her nisuin, so he must have accepted the mumim. From his side, we had only one chazaka, which was that people don't accept mumim. But why don't we add on top of that, you also have chazkat mamon. And then you would have two against two. What happens to chazkat mamon in the first case, where he found, I mean, he has proof of the mumim after Irusin? That goes back to what we discussed before in yesterday's daf, which is that Rabbi Gamliel will say that when there's a chezkat aguf, chezkat mamon is irrelevant. In the first case where the chezkat aguf is there, because we said emun gufo bechezkato, that the woman was born shalem, and therefore we assume that she was shalem during the period of the Erusin, over there the chezkat mamon is irrelevant. That's what Rabbi Gamliel said earlier in the Masechta. When you have a challenge or a tension between chezkat aguf and chezkat mamon, chezkat aguf trumps, chezkat mamon is meaningless. So that's why in the first case, where chezkat aguf is there, the chezkat mamon is irrelevant. But in the second part here, where he has edim that there was a mum there before the erusin, at that point there's no more chezkat aguf. So since there's no chezkat aguf, also now chezkat mamon has meaning, because chezkat aguf is gone. And that's why only in the second scenario here, where he can prove that there were mumim before erusin, does chezkat mamon bubble up and help him out. Whereas in the scenario before, where the chezkat aguf was still in force, there chezkat mamon has no power. Because against chezkat aguf, chezkat mamon is meaningless. We're assuming here that Rava's answer is Alpi Rabban Gamliel, because the halacha is like Rabban Gamliel, and therefore Rava has an incentive to set up the Mishnah, Kulo Kerabi Gamliel. And in doing so, chezkat aguf is paramount, and if you have chezkat aguf, chezkat mamon is meaningless. Whereas when you don't have chezkat aguf, then chezkat mamon is meaningful, and that's why we raised it in the second scenario where chezkat aguf disappeared. That's the shita for Rava. Tosafot asks a very, very interesting question over here, and he says, somewhat along the lines of, David, what you're asking now, if you were to take each of these things independently and weigh them, we would actually say that one trumps the other. But now also when you bring them together, we say that the baal is out of luck. So how does that work? Because he says, if you looked at Ein Adam Mefayes B'Mumim versus Ein Adam Shoteh B'Kos Elim Ken Bodko, we would definitely, those are one against one, we would definitely say that there's a stronger side to say that a person would not accept the Mumim. So if you just had those one against the other, the Baal would trump in that case and say, listen, the person would never accept Mumim like this, and that would win. Also in the case where if you just had Kan Nimtzu'u Kan Hayu, that where they were found, that's where they were, that is stronger than chezkat aguf. So if you found the mumim in the Beit Aviyah, then that would trump chezkat aguf by itself. So if you found them in the father's household, then that would trump chezkat aguf. If you had just the mumim here to think about what a person's mindset is, to say he will accept mumim, he won't accept mumim, we would definitely say he wouldn't accept mumim. So now those each independently, the husband would have trumped in each of those two scenarios. Now we bring them together, and the husband loses. Because all of a sudden now, when he has both of these, he has the fact that the mum was found in the father's house, because he already has edim, that's mishanit arsa, so that it definitely happened in the father's house. Number two is, he has a chazakah supporting him, that he wouldn't accept mumim. And yet we say, when we put together the two items, one item which is the chazakah, he already is married to her and he accepted it, as well as the chazkat aguf, that the woman was shalem, and therefore at the time of Erusin, that it was fine. So now you have these two against two, and he loses. If he had each one of them independently, he would have won. Now when he puts them together, he loses. Why should his taina be worse when he has two things in his favor? Tosafot says, first answer he gives is, that when each one of them is independent, we append the chezkat mamon to his taina, and that helps him out. But when you have these two things together, the chezkat mamon is no longer relevant. It's an interesting answer, although it's difficult to understand why that would be, but Tosafot speculates. But then he gives a second answer, which is very interesting. He says, Ve'ish Lamar, there's a difference about the burden of proof over here. All the woman needs is one of the two sides to be true, and she wins. The husband needs both items to be true in order for him to win. So in the scenario here where, again, he has, an Adam would not accept Mumim. Plus, on his favor, he has that it was found in the father's house. Both of those have to be true in order for him to trump. On the other hand, for the woman to trump over here, all she has to do is prove that one of those two is not true. Either that he got married to her already, and now that he accepted the Mumim, that's enough to ruin it all for him. Or, all she has to have is Chazkat Aguf. The Chazkat Aguf by itself is enough for her to prove that she was Shalaim, and therefore, since he only proved it after Erusin, it's his problem, and it didn't happen prior to Erusin. So since, in this case, the husband would need both to be true in order to win, versus the woman who would only need one of them to be in her favor to win, therefore, there's a stronger side for her than there is for him. Because he needs everything here. He needs 100% in order to win. She only needs 50%. One of the two things to be true in order for her to win in this case. And that's why we lean in favor of the woman in the case where, even though independently, each one of these, the husband would have trumped. But when you put them together, then the woman has a better scenario. Because she just needs to disprove one to win. He needs to prove both in order to win. Right now we have a third answer. Ravashi Amar, Reisha Mane La'aba Biyadecha. The Reisha is a case where she's making a claim on behalf of another party. And the Seifa is Maneli Biyadecha. The Seifa is a case where she's making a claim on behalf of herself. So the way Rashi explains it, Tosfot brings an alternative and in the end says that Rashi's explanation is Ikar. Which is that back earlier in the Masechta, and the beginning of the second Perek, we talked about a son coming and making a claim that you have money that is owed to my father. In that case, when the son makes such a claim, he can only make a claim of Shema. He doesn't have a Bari claim. He doesn't have a definitive claim because it's not him. He wasn't the party to the transaction. So he's making a Shema claim. You know, you have my father's money. Come and pay up. If the other party says, I already paid it, that's a strong enough statement, a Bari statement against the statement of the Shema. Over here as well, until the point of Nisuin, the woman is an Arusa. If she gets divorced from the Erusin, the Ktuba would belong to her father. So therefore, the claim for the money over here is her father's claim. On the other hand, the Chezkat Aguf, which is supporting that claim, is her Chezkat Aguf. So what Rashi says is the two are actually separated in that case. The claim is a monetary claim for the father, and the Chazakah is the Chazakah of the woman herself. Yes, if you join them together, then you have a more powerful claim, but you can't join them together because they're really, in a sense, the pieces of evidence don't match. The one who's making the claim, for instance, the father who's making the claim for the money, then he doesn't have the Chezkat Aguf. The woman who has the Chezkat Aguf can't make the claim because she can only make a Shema claim, she can't make a Bari claim. On the other hand, when it comes to post-Nisuin, when she's in Reshut HaBaal, then the monies of the Ktuba will belong to her. Because when she's in Nisuah, she's left the auspices of her father, and the claim for the money is her own claim now. So now when she's making a claim for the money and the Chezkat Aguf, right, are on her side, then the burden of proof is on him, because she now is making the claim and has the Chazakah in her favor. And so again, Rav Ashi is setting this up like Rabban Gamliel, who says that the Chezkat Aguf trumps, and the only difference here is between who is the claimant. The Chezkat Aguf trumps. So that's the basic factor. Her Chazakah of Aguf is that she is a Shlema. When does the Chezkat Aguf help her? When she's the claimant. She's only the claimant post-Nisuin. When she's the claimant prior to Nisuin, the clear claimant is the father. And the Chezkat Aguf is not for him because it's her Chezkat Aguf, and therefore the evidence or the Chazakah don't join together with the claim. So that's the way Rav Ashi explains it. Eitvei Rav Acha Breid Rav Avya Rav Ashi. So now Rav Acha Breid Rav Avya challenges Rav Ashi from the Tosefta, which is Mode Rabbi Meir b'mumim aruim lavoima bebeit avia shalav lavi raya. Even Rabbi Meir agrees that if these are mumim that should have happened in her father's house, then the father has to bring a raya. V'amai? Why should the father have to bring a raya? Maneh li biyadecho. Already we're post nisuin and she's making the claim, and since she's making the claim and she has the Chezkat Aguf, that should trump over here. Why does it matter that these are mumim that should have happened or probably happened in her father's house because it's unlikely that they happen now? Why should that matter at all? The only thing that matters is Chazkat Aguf, as well as whether she can make a direct claim. And here she can make a direct claim. Where it says, Hachamayaskinon, what are we doing with over here? Be a teret. It's a case where she has an extra limb, an extra finger or an extra toe. So now, if it's a yeteret, then for sure that happened prior, and there's no cheskad aguf anymore. That's a congenital problem. Congenital problem clearly even happened before the erusin. In that case, Rabbi Meir would agree that there's just no way that you can claim that this happened in the Baal's house. She didn't just grow an extra limb in the Baal's house. Where it says, Yeteret, my raya mighty. So then, what's Rabbi Meir saying? If it's a congenital problem, what proof could the father ever bring that would support his position? He for sure has a mekach ta'ut on his hands here, because it clearly happened way before the erusin. And if that's the case, why would it be a raya? Raya, the raw vinifayisu. Exactly what you're suggesting. That the, if it's a yeteret, and it should have been something that he could have caught, then the raya that he can prove is that the husband knew about it, and he accepted it. That's exactly the proof. Okay, so if it's something that nobody sees, then the father can't make such a claim that he saw it and was nefayis. It'd be much harder for him to make the claim. If it's something that is more obvious or begilui, then he can bring a proof that the husband accepted, knew about it, and accepted it. And that's it. We're done, because that's the raya that he can bring. So here you have a congenital problem, which clearly happened in the father's house. That's why Rabbi Meir says, for sure, the burden of proof is on the father now. What proof could he bring? The only proof he could bring is that, not that it wasn't there, but that the husband knew about it and accepted it. And that'll be the issue with Kodesh, Moda Rabbi Meir. Now, in terms of, Rashi just says over here, Moda Rabbi Meir, Gassina Bitosefta. That's the Girsa. Tosafot over here plays around with that and says that it's not so clear that Rabbi Meir is more Machmir than the Chachamim. And therefore, he would give more power to the father in general, unless this case, this scenario where the father has no legs to stand on. But he says in the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir sounds just the opposite. And then Tosafot says, well, if you flip the girsa and say, Mode Chachamim, the Rabbi Meir, he says it also doesn't fit in. He says, Bekunches Garis, Mode Rabbi Meir, Betulo. He just says, Mode Rabbi Meir, no more. Fakasha, Mode Laman. Who's he admitting to? So Tosafot's trying to figure out, is it Rabbi Meir admitting to the Chachamim, Chachamim to Rabbi Meir? Over here, he just says, Moda Rabbi Meir. But who's Rabbi Meir admitting to? Rashi never clarifies for us who exactly Rabbi Meir is being Moda to. But he just says, this is the case. This is what Rabbi Meir says. And therefore, Rashi avoids the problem of trying to figure out versus whom is he saying this that changes his day'ah. Because Tosafot says he raises the issue as to who is Moda Rabbi Meir and what is his position in other scenarios. Doesn't work out so easily. Rashi avoided the problem by just simply Moda Rabbi Meir without giving context to the Moda Rabbi Meir. The Mishnah talks about the house that he has relatives in the bathhouse and they can figure it out. So if he should have known about it, then we say that he accepted it. If he couldn't have known about it and he only finds it afterwards, then again, then you can't say that he accepted it. Then we have to move to the other, when did it happen? Because if it happened even after every sin, it's his problem, because Nistafkas Tadeu. That means that it was his bad luck. If it happened after erusin. So the problem is not simply that he found it now. The question is, when did it happen? And so therefore, even if he finds it now and he says, I couldn't have known about it, so I didn't accept it, we still have to then figure out all the other pieces of the puzzle, which is, when did it happen? And that will depend on the three answers that we just gave over here, that Rabbi Lazar says, Tavra, Misha Shana Zu, Lo Shana Zu, that these are two different authorships in the Mishnah. We had Rava's answer, which is, wherever it's found, that's where it happened. And then we worked out the different scenarios. And then you have Rav Ashi over here saying, depending who the claimant is, Chesed HaGuf is paramount. And whoever is the claimant, then if she's the claimant, she wins no matter what, because she has both things in her favor. If the claimant is on the behalf of her father, then she can't, because the Chazakah and her claim do not line up. All right, now, I'm Rav Yehuda Mar Shmuel. Now we're going to extend this to other cases. HaMachlit Parah B'Chamor. They are bartering. So they exchange a Parah and a Chamor. U'Mashach Bala Chamor et HaParah. And the Bala Chamor made a kinyan on the parah. Once he's made a kinyan on the parah, the deal is done. You don't need both parties to make a kinyan. Once one of the parties makes a kinyan, then because it's a barter exchange, that's enough to shift the other item to the other party. So here, where the Bala Chamor takes the parah, he now has his parah. Automatically, the Chamor now goes over to the Bala Parah. V'lo yispik Bala Parah l'mshochet ha-chamor ad shemet ha-chamor. But the Bala Parah doesn't get the Chamor in his possession, the Chamor is dead. And of course the question is, when did it die? Did it die before the Kinyan or after the Kinyan? In whose possession did the Chamor die? Did the Chamor die prior to the Kinyan, and therefore it's the Bala Chamor's problem? Or did the Chamor die after the Kinyan, and it's really the Bala Parah's problem now, because he owned the Chamor and it died in his possession? So here it says, Ala Bala Chamor La Viraya, Shaya Chamoro Kayam Bishat Neshichat Parah. The burden of proof is on the owner of the chamor to show that his chamor was alive when the kinyan took place. Vatana tuna. And the Tana says, The proof is Mikala. The proof is from our Mishnah. So he says, the reason that the Bala Chamorah has the burner proof is our Mishnah. So the Gemara wants to know, hey Kala, which Kala in our Mishnah gives you that feeling? It says, Ilema, if you want to say it's Kala Bebeta Via, that it's a Kala in her father's house, Midomi. Can you really compare the cases? Now Rashi over here explains, so really the Shmuel Rabbi Elazar. Shmuel holds like Rabbi Elazar, the Mukila betrayed Tanae, that he explained our Mishnah as being authored by two Tanaim. Which means that Rabbi Gamliel would say the same thing all the way through, and Rabbi Yoshua would say the same thing all the way through. Which means that in the case of whether it was found in the father's house, or whether it was found in the husband's house, and the burden of proof is always on the father's. So they're saying the same thing here. So if, what do you want to say here? Just like there, even if the Safek was nolad in the house of the Baal, the burden of proof is always on the father. And that's despite the fact that the Riuta happened in the Baal's possession, so too over here. We want to suggest the same thing, that even though technically it seems like it happened in the possession of the Bala Para, nevertheless the Bala Chamor has the obligation over here. So even though the Safek did not happen in his Rishut, so too over here. Even though the Mishichat HaParah took place, and the Mishichat happened, and the Safek was nolad in the, really, what seemingly is the Baal HaParah's possession, the Chamor was already in his possession. And therefore, we would assume that the Safek, the death, happened when it was seemingly in his possession. Nevertheless, the burden of proof is on the Baal HaChamor. So that's how we'll compare the cases. The Gemara says, Midomi, they're not comparable. Hata Maiti Avraya Umepik. Over there, the father brings a proof, and he can take money. He extracts money from the husband. The husband is the holder of the tuba. And therefore, the father brings a raya that things were not his problem. It didn't happen under his watch. And he's tovea, he gets the money. Yet over here, of a hocha, mighty Bala Chamor raya umukim. The other hand here, the Bala Chamor brings a raya and he keeps what he has already. The para is already in his possession. So he brings a proof and he gets to keep the para. But the para is already in his possession. The other hand, in the case of our Mishnah, the father brings a proof, and he gets to extract money. So there's a different type of scenario over here. You can't compare the scenarios. In one scenario, you have the Chezkat HaMamon is supporting you. So for instance, by the Bala Chamor, the Chezkat HaMamon is supporting him because he's holding the para. And he brings the proof, then he can hold on to the para. In our case here, the Chezkat HaMamon is with the Baal. And yet, when the father brings the raya, he's able to extract the mamon from the husband. So these are not similar cases in that way. Because this is according to Rabbi Elazar. That's what Rashi says. It's not according to Rava. If it was according to Rava, then he wouldn't have a question here. Rashi says, we're assuming here that Shmuel is holding like Rabbi Elazar, the Tavra Mishishanazu, Lo Shanazu. And therefore, according to the Tana of the Reisha, the Tana of the Reisha says that the burner proof is on the father. And that means no matter where the Safek was nolad, even if the Safek was nolad in the house of the Baal, the burden of proof is always on the father. So the same thing over here. The burden of proof is on the Bala Chamor, even though the Safek was nolad seemingly after the Mishichat HaPara. So where it says, wait a minute, the power of the father in the Mishnah is much different than the power of the Bala Chamor over here. Bala Chamor here is only just trying to keep things in the status quo. Over there, the father has enough power that when he brings the proof, he's going to actually extract money based on that. So you can't say that these cases are necessarily comparable. So Gemara says, no, I'm Rabbi Avo Kala Bebeit Chamia. It's a case of the Kala in her father-in-law's house. She's in the Beshut HaBaal already. The reason that they're saying Kala Bebeit Chamia, because it used the term Kala. So now, you can't say that Beshut HaBaal, because then she's no longer a Kala. So that's what they meant. Kala Bebeit Chamia versus Kala Bebeit Chamia. One is in the Beshut HaAv, and the other one is in Beshut HaBaal. Basically, he's saying that it's the second half of the Mishnah. The second half of the Mishnah says that the burden of proof is on the husband, no matter where this safek took place. Now, in the case of the husband, he's trying to maintain the status quo. He's trying to hold the money of the tuba in his possession. So now we have a comparable case. There, the husband is holding the money in his possession. And over here, the Bala Chamor is trying to keep the para in his possession. And in both of these cases, we say no matter where the safek was nolad, the burden of proof is on the one who wants to keep or maintain the status quo. Vakati lo domi. So it's still not similar. Hatam baal mighty raya umrale the cheske da'av. Because when the Baal brings a proof, then he undermines the chazakah of the Av. Hacha bala chamor maiti raya, umukim chazkei biyadei. And then he maintains the status quo, the chazakah in place. Because over here, when you have what's called the chazkat ha-guf, supports the father's position, because the chazkat ha-guf is the woman didn't have a mum. Once the husband brings a raya, that wasn't the case, that there was some problem in this woman, he's now undermined the chazkat ha-guf, because she's proven that there was a mum there, and therefore he's able to maintain the status quo and keep his money, because he ruined the chazakah. Over here, that may not be the case, because who's the chazakah is in favor of the Baal HaChamor. Because the chamor was alive. And the chazakah was that it would remain alive. And therefore, our assumption is that it died in the possession of the Baal HaPara. So now here, the Baal HaChamor, who has the para in his possession, in order to keep the para, he has to just uphold his chazakah. So you're dealing with different types of evidence here. One case, the husband brings evidence to the fact that the chazakah that we're relying on was no good, and he gets to keep his money. Over here, you're saying to the Baal HaChamor, you have to uphold the chazakah that exists already in order to keep your money. Again, that's not a comparable case, because the chazakah is in his favor and remains in his favor. Versus in the Mishnah, where the chazakah was against him, and now he changes the chazakah and flips it on its head to say that it's no longer a good chazakah. So the cases are not comparable. So Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Kala Bebeit Avia. Now we're back to assuming that we're talking about a Kala in her father's house. And the question here is not about the Tuba, but rather about the monies of the Kiddushin. The monies of the Kiddushin, the husband paid money, gave over money to establish the Kiddushin. Can he get his money back? Can he get a refund of his Kiddushin over here? So now the money's moving in the opposite direction. Talking about the case of Kiddushin now. Question is, how did he even get there? Like, why are we talking about Kesef Kiddushin? Our Mishnah doesn't seem to be talking about Kesef Kiddushin. The answer might be, the Ramban suggests over here, it's an interesting answer, is that generally an Arusa is not entitled to a Ketubah. Ketubah is associated with Nisuin. We saw that earlier in the Masechta Machlokes between Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel, whether Arusa by default has a Ketubah or should expect a Ketubah. So generally we believe that a Ketubah is associated with a Nisuah. If that's the case here, then the only monetary issue here is the Kesef Kiddushin, not the Tuba. So now the question is, can the husband get a refund? Here's the case where the Safek was no lad in the father's house. So again, the Safek is no lad in the other party's house. And we're going with the ratio of the Mishnah. The ratio of the Mishnah says the burden of proof is always on the father. So over here, you have the same scenario now. The father is bringing proof to maintain the status quo. He has the Kesef Kiddushin now. He wants to keep the Kesef Kiddushin. So he's got to bring a proof to maintain the Kesef Kiddushin. Same is true of the Baal HaChamor. The para is in his possession. He wants to bring a proof to maintain the status quo that the para will remain in his possession. Now you have comparable cases, and that's why our Mishnah would support this understanding by the case of the Chamor and the para. Velo teima lima demanda amara kiddushin lav letibuin itnu. The tibuin means like tobeya, to drown, to be lost. The husband, once he's given the Kesef Kiddushin, he basically can assume he'll never see them again. There's no refunds, there's no backsees. When it comes to Kiddushin, it's done. According to what it says, that it's not a permanent thing, and he can reverse the Kiddushin and get his money back over there. Even in the case, the Mandamar, Kiddushin, the Tvuyim Nitnu. In general, once you give the money of Kiddushin, you can't get them back. Over here, the father will still have to bring a proof. Well, why? Kiddushin, once he gives it, belongs to the father, he can't get a refund on this. Hani milei Kiddushei Vadai. That's only when the husband produces Kiddushin that are in full force. When the Kiddushin are in full force, then we assume that when he gave the money to the Kiddushin, he doesn't expect to see them back. Again, it's machloket. But according to that daya that says he won't see them back, then that's a permanent thing, and even if something goes wrong, he can't get his money back. Aval Kiddushei Ta'ot, if there was a Mekach Ta'ot over here, he might tiraya in Ilolo. In a case where there is a claim of Mekach Ta'ot over here, the father's got to bring a proof to hold on to the Kesef Kiddushin. He can't just say, oh, you gave Kesef Kiddushin, you're done. Now, over there, because there's a mistake in the underlying transaction that created the Kiddushin, that unwinds this idea that the Kiddushin are permanent, no refund. And therefore, even according to one who says, normally you can't get your money back with Kiddushin, over here, he would agree you could get your money back, and therefore the father has an obligation to prove that he's allowed to hold on to the money in this case. Now, I would just say that Rashi over here once again says that Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak saying this in the position of Rabbi Elazar, Tavra Mishu Shanazu, Lo Shanazu, that he's saying this all along. What we're assuming here is that this is all being done in the position of Rabbi Elazar. Tosfot over here questions that. Rashi himself asked a question, and we know that Shmuel in the first parak paskin like Rabban Gamliel. So why would he say over here, Tavra Mishishanazu, Lo Shanazu? He'd much more likely to say the Aloch is like Rabban Gamliel and explain the case over here like Ravashi or like Rava, like you were asking before. Why not say it like Ravashi and Rava? Because then you won't have these issues. Rashi says, hey, you can't say that. And later on, you're going to see you're right. We're going to reject this whole thing for Shmuel, and we're going to change everything around. But at this point in the Gemara, there's no way that you can be mukimit like Rava and Ravashi. Yev shalomar. The kasha the Rava of Ravashi, maditan daf koktani. Rei shala'av v'seif alabal. Shasafek nolad birshutan. V'ilu Shmuel, amish lo nolad asafek birshuto, itzrich levakesh raya. Because according to Rava and Ravashi, wherever the safek was nolad, that's where the burden of proof is. Over here, we want to have it that the safek is in one possession, and nevertheless, it's the other party's responsibility. The only one in our Mishnah who says something like that is Rabbi Lazar, who says, Tavra Misha Shanazu, Lo Shanazu, who says it has nothing to do with where the safek was nolad, it's just a question of who the burden of proof is on. So therefore, he says it's like Rabbi Lazar. Tosafot takes issue with this, and he says he can't believe that that's the case, because Shmuel clearly paskins like Rabban Gamliel. And therefore, he says, near the Freish, the Shmuel Karavashi. Shmuel here is like Ravashi, and therefore, Hashtolo Mafli Midei Ben Nolad Safek Bishuto Lo Nolad Bishuto. But there's no difference. But for Rova, where it's, if it was found here, that's where the problem, or that's where the burden of proof is, he can't hold like Rova. But Ravashi, at least we can make a claim here that there's a reason to believe that even if the Safek was Nolad in the other party's possession, nevertheless, it could still be that the other party has to bring a Raya. Just like over there, that Avagav Da'av Muchzak, even though the father has the money, Tzarich Lavi Raya, he still has to bring a proof, to Chezkat Aguf Dida Lo Mahani Da'av, because here Chezkat Aguf doesn't help him, HaChanami, Hochal Balachamor Lavi Raya, the Balachamor has to bring a proof, Afal Pishu Muchzak, even though he's the holder of the Parah right now, the Chezkat Chamor Lo Mahani Lagabi Didei, because the Chezkat Chamor is not going to help the fact that he has the Parah in his possession. But also it creates a quasi-scenario where you could fit it into Ravashi in order to make it simpler to understand the Shita of Shmuel. But Ravashi says over here that it is Alpi, the Shita of Rabbi Elazar. Now the Gemara asks, Meitave, from a case in Chulin, Machat shenimtzeit ba'ovei beit hakosot. You found a pin or a needle after they shechted the animal in the beit hakosot. The beit hakosot is in the beginning of the area of the stomach. Over there, there's a loop down that looks like a kos. That's why it's called beit hakosot. And over there was something that punctured, a needle that punctured the wall of the beit hakosot, which is a trefa. Because that's a hole in the keres, and that would be a trefa. The only thing unique about the beit hakosot is that it has a double layer. So that the pin would actually have to go through both layers in order for it to be a trefa. So that's what the Mishnah says. Machat shenimtzeit ba'ovi beit hakosot, mitzad echad. You can only find the hole of the pin on one side, then it's a kshera, because the film on the other side would protect it, because it's a double layer. Mishnei tzadim, if you can see the pinhole all the way through, and the pins all the way through, then it's definitely a trefa, because now you have a hole in the stomach. Nimtza alea koret dam. If you find blood on the pin, biyadua shlifnei shchita, then you know it definitely happened prior to the shchita, because the dam being on the pin indicates that the pin went through when the animal still had dam in it and was alive. And therefore, the blood is now on the pin itself. Lo nimtza alea korat dam. If we do not find any korat dam, biyadua shlachar shchita, then we know it happened after shchita. If there's no blood on the pin, then that's evidence of the fact that this happened at a much later stage. The animal was dead, and therefore, there was no blood to go on to the pin at that point in time. Huglad piyamakeh. If there's already a scab on this hole around where the pin has gone through, biyadua shlosh yamim kodem shchita. Then we know it definitely happened 3 days prior, because and you need enough time for the blood to coagulate and create a scab over there. So unless there's a scab or some sort of reparative build on top of it, you know this already happened 3 days ago because it takes time for that to happen. Lo hugad piyamakeh, in the case where we don't have any evidence of that, then hamotzi michaveru olav araya. Here the problem, the burden of proof is on the one who wants to take the money. So in this scenario, you basically have a case where the owner of the animal sells the animal to the butcher in order to shech the animal and then sell the animal. So the question is, where did this animal become a trefa? Was it a trefa in the possession of the owner? Or did it become a trefa in the possession of the tabach, of the butcher? So in cases where we can prove that it happened prior or after shchita, then all those things help us. If it happened after shchita, then there's no trefa here, there's nothing to discuss. If it happened before shchita, Then we have Etshreifa. Now, whose possession did it happen in? Whose possession was it? Before Shechita, you have a large amount of time. Some of that time it belonged to the owner, some of the time it was in the Tabach's possession. So in a case where we have a scab there, we know it happened 3 days ago, it was definitely in the possession of the owner, not in the possession of the Tabach, because it's too old. The hole is too old for it to happen in the hands of the Tabach. But in a case where we have no scab, or no buildup around the needle, then we don't know when it happened. So now each one makes a claim. The Tabach says it happened while he was with you. When you owned it, that's when it happened. And the other guy says, no, I sold it to you as a ksheira, and it happened after it was already in your possession. So there, motzi mi chavareo ala varaya. Over there, the burden of proof is on the one who wants to extract money. V'yayib tabach demayeh. If the butcher already paid money, he has to bring a raya in order to remove the money. Vamai. Why is that the case? Even if in this case the safek was nolad in the hands of the tabach, according to Shmuel's understanding over here, the obligation of the burden of proof should be on the owner of the animal who sold it to the butcher to bring the proof and then maintain the status quo. Shmuel is saying over here that the burden of proof and the safek is nolad, no matter where, in whoever reshut, the safek is nolad, the burden of proof is always on the one who wants to maintain the status quo. Over here, the one who wants to maintain the status quo is the owner of the animal, and he's holding the money now, and he wants to keep that money. Just like the father wants to keep the kesef kiddushin, so he has to bring the burden of proof. So too, it's like that in the case of the bala chamor, wants to maintain the parah in his position. We say even though the safek was nolad in the other party's possession, the burden of proof is on him. So in all these cases, we're saying the burden of proof is on the one who wants to maintain the status quo. Why don't we say the same thing over here? So Gemara says, all right, below yoiv tab chodame. It's a case where the butcher didn't give the money already. It's a case where he didn't give the money yet. And now the bala beima has got to bring a raya to extract the money. Gemara says, my pascha. How do you know? I mean, either of these cases, no matter which scenario you come up with, how do you know that all transactions are where the butcher gave the money or he didn't give the money? Over there, it doesn't tell you who paid, who didn't pay. It just says a statement, a moti mi chavero la varaya, which means no matter who's holding the money, the other party's got to bring the proof. So how do you know that the scenario is a scenario where he didn't pay the money? Why don't we say it the other way around? It's a case where the tabach gave the money already. And that would go against what Shmuel said over here, because over there we'd say moti mi chavero la varaya means the burden of proof was on the tabach. So you're saying, no, it's a case where the tabach didn't give the money. And now the bala beima has got to bring a raya to extract the money. In this case, the safek was nolad in the hands of the tabach. And now he wants to extract money. Mar says, my pascha, how do you know what happened here in the transaction? You don't know if the tabach gave money, didn't give money. It should be in all scenarios. The Mishnah doesn't differentiate. How can you say it's only in that scenario that that's what the Mishnah is saying? That's not the case. Elkiati Rami Bar Yechezkel Amar Lo Titzatinu Lani Klalei Dekal Yehuda Achim Mishmei DeShmuel. Don't listen to those things that my brother said in the name of Shmuel, which is the beginning of this Gemara. Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel Amachli Para BeChamor Meshach Bala Chamor Et Para Lo Yispik Bala Para Lemeshoch Et Chamor Ad Shemeit HaChamor Bala Chamor La Viraya Shaya Chamor O Kayam Bishat Neshichat Para V'Tana Tuna Kala. That's what Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel. Yechezkel, his brother, says Rabbi Yehuda got it all wrong. That's not Shmuel's opinion. I'll tell you Shmuel's opinion. So hachi amar Shmuel. Kol shenolad safek b'shuto alav araya. Wherever the safek happened, that's where the burden of proof is. So now, according to this, our Mishnah then is one Tano, and he's holding like Rava now. He's holding like Rava that wherever the safek was nolad, that's who has the burden of proof. Vatani tunakalo. Now it sounds like our Mishnah, because according to Rava, that's exactly what happens. Wherever the safek was nolad, that's who has the burden of proof. That's so too, by the bala chamor, wherever the safek was nolad, that's the one who has the burden of proof. Now Gemara says, Meitevei, machat shenim tsepo v'yibeta kasot, our case of chulin. Over there, the burden of proof is on a motzi mechavereo. It's not where the safek was nolad. The safek was nolad with the tabach. And yet we still say, whoever wants to extract the money, he's got to bring the burden of proof. So that means if the tabach didn't pay yet, then the Bala Behemah has got to bring it, even though the safek happened b'shuta tabach. If the tabach didn't give money yet, Bala Behemah buy the tuya raya. The Bala Behemah brings the raya umepik to take money out. V'amai sveka b'shuta tabach yijaleid. The safek happened in the hands of the tabach, and the burden of proof should be on him. When it says diyayiv tabach demei, case where the tabach already gave up the money, he already paid the money. So now, tabach paid the money. Now the tabach's got to bring the proof. The safek happened in his possession, and he's got to bring the proof. But how do you know that the tabach already gave the money? Am I Pascha? The Gemara asks the same question again. How do you know that the scenario is that the tabach gave the money already? Stama de milta, the Gemara says, that's because that's the normal way transactions work. Kama de lo yoyevinish zuzei, lo yoyevinish chivuta. That people will not give up their animal until they see the cash. People will not give over their behemah until they see the cash. The fact that the tabach has the animal in his possession now means that he paid already. And therefore, that stam case in the Mishnah is a case where the tabach already gave up the money. So then when you say, amotzi mechavero laveraya, you know who the burden of proof is on? The tabach. And that's the same thing that Shmuel would say, because the safek happened in the possession of the tabach. And therefore, the burden of proof is on the tabach. And this corroborates what Shmuel is saying, which is that whoever has the safek happen in his reshut, that's who has the burden of proof over here. And therefore, in the case of the kala, if it's bebeit avia, the burden of proof is on the father. If it's bebeit abal, the burden of proof is on the baal. It's all according to Rabban Gamliel, as we saw in the sheet of Rabba before. In the case of the chamor, then it's on the bala para to bring the raya, because the chamor was mate, and the safek happened is reshut, because lo nimsa chamor mate ad achar mishichat para. So therefore, since it happened in his watch, it's al bala para lavi et araya, opposite of what Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, that it was on the bala chamor's responsibility. Here he's saying it's on the bala para to bring it. It's his responsibility because the safek was nolad bir shuto. Now the Gemara says, that's when the mumim are not visible. But if the mumim are visible, then he knows about it and he accepted it. So Amar Rav Nachman, v'nichpe kimumim shebeseter, dummy. A woman who has dropsy or epilepsy, that's like a mumim shebeseter, because she can cover that up. There's no way that the husband will know that she has such an item. V'ani mile d'gvile zman. That's only true if she has these on regular occurrences, on a regular interval, because then she can prevent the husband from ever knowing about it. She'll always not be around when these incidents or these epileptic fits happen. She won't be around, and so the husband will never know about it. If it's something that is not happen on a regular interval at a regular time, then it'll be the equivalent of a mumim shibigaloi, because she could be, at any time she's present with the husband, it could happen. She can't hide it because she doesn't know when it's going to happen. Since she doesn't know when it happened, it's something like mumim shibigaloi, because everybody will know about it, because it happens at these awkward moments at bad times, and you don't have a choice about it hiding it, because you don't know when to hide it. And therefore, it's considered to be a mumim shibigaloi in that case. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Ayin Zayin Amud Aleph.